Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network, sponsored by TBILaw.com.
For automatic reminders about this radio show and other great survivor events,
sign up now for TBIFM.org.
When Attorney Gordon Johnson speaks about recovery, he isn't talking about the amount of money a survivor gets from a lawsuit or settlement. He is talking about getting better from the brain injury. Find him on the web at TBIGore.com or call 800-992-9447.
And now, it is time for another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
Hello, welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network. Tonight is our regular Wednesday installment of our program Recovery Now with your host, Kim Justice. If you'd like to know more about my story, you can find it at inaflash.org. I, too, am a fellow traumatic brain injury survivor. I appreciate you tuning in tonight, and as always, I look forward to your input. So now, we'll get on with the show.
Pop, 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 pop. Greetings, everybody, from the heartland where it is looking like summer today. I think we probably have about 95 degrees and a big amount of humidity. So I really have no right to complain. This has been an odd year with a cool summer, but today I'm feeling it. I'm feeling that heat. I want to thank Dr. Bob Coover, one of our new hosts on Wednesday night. He just finished up his program called Shaken Not Stirred. It's a show about Parkinson's disease and caregiving involved. And Dr. Bob, I think this was his second show. He's on the first, third, and fifth Wednesdays, if there is a fifth Wednesday, of each month, and he would be on at 5 o'clock Pacific. So just before this show, he is on, and on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month is Lori Purdy-Fidel, who does The Science of Happiness. So as we're getting all of our listeners used to the new platform up in front of us, the new set of programs, I just want to thank the two great hosts that are ahead of me each week and all of the other new hosts that we've got coming on board, and just let you guys know that now instead of 3 or 4 hours straight, we're more like 5 hours straight of Brain Injury Radio. In any case, thank you all for being here tonight. I appreciate you guys listening and your support of the show. Just to make a couple announcements before I bring on my guest, give people a chance to get logged in. Let's see, one of those is Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week with 10 different hosts in this block of shows. The shows, after they're live, within about an hour, go into the archive, so they're available on demand. So you never have to be alone in your recovery as, well, say I was. For 17 years, I never had met another survivor. And it took me writing a book and becoming a radio host to get to meet some. And for that, I've been truly blessed most of the last year. In any case, the live programming is on every night, and you're welcome to listen to the on-demand programming whenever the mood strikes. And so, like I said, you'll know that you're never alone. Also want to let you know, and I'll type this one in the chat room for anyone who's looking, the number 4, P as in Paul, EER11.org, 4peer11.org, is a site to be checked out. for a couple of different reasons. One of the other projects we have going on here at Brain Injury Radio is the development of a peer-to-peer support line where one survivor can talk to another. Ultimately, this is going to be a 24/7 proposition, but we're only, I think, at 8 to 10 hours now, and it only takes a commitment of 4 hours a month. We're looking for more volunteers, and you can get information at that website, both on being a volunteer, where you go through a little bit of training first so that you know what we do talk about and what we don't on these calls. Some calls will need a referral. Sometimes it's just listening and one survivor talking to another, but it will tell you both how to access that support number as well as how to become a volunteer. And if you're looking for a sense of purpose or a way to help another survivor, this is just really a great way to do it. So check that out. You can also find at that site the medical ID card. It's about the size of a driver's license with one of those swipey strips on back, and it can hold a lot of your medical information. And if you're not the kind to wear Medic Alert jewelry, but you would have some problems if you were knocked unconscious or perhaps confronted by police officers, depending on some of the situations I've heard in the time that I've been a host, it's good to have this card on you so that you can be identified as somebody who might have some brain trauma issues. And so be sure to check that out. I also want to thank our sponsor, Brain Injury Radio sponsor, Gordon Johnson of TBILaw.com, and the Recovery Now sponsor, my sponsor, Lash Publishing. That's LAPublishing.com. And I'm really excited. I'll put in the chat room just after a little while when I bring on Robin, my guest. The August issue did come out, and I'm going to go ahead and put in the chat room, and for those of you listening, if you go to lapublishing.com, you'll see on the left side, there's a list going down the left side of the homepage, there's a list, and just a third of the way down from the top, it says Brain Injury Journey. If you click on that, it will take you to a page about their new magazine as of April, and you'll see where you can sign up for the written subscription for the print issue, or if you scroll down about halfway, you are able to get the online edition of this magazine for free, and you can't beat that price. I strongly encourage you to check that out, and I'll find the exact page and put it up for you a little bit later, but again, lapublishing.com, and check out Brain Injury Journey magazine. As a matter of fact, you really want to sign up if you haven't already. The August issue just came out, and I was really excited because yours truly has an article in this month's edition, and that was pretty cool. And then I noticed that a little bit later in the magazine, someone else wrote an article about veterans, and a lot of you are here that I see. We're here for my program, Final Salute, right around 4th of July, and they did put in the link for that program with this gentleman's article, which I thought was pretty cool. So Brain Injury Radio is getting around, and I want to thank Lash Publishing for their part in that. So with that, I think we've given everybody time to come in and get a comfortable chair. So I will tell you that Robin J. Bloom is the author of My Days of Brain Injury and the expanded sequel that came out recently, Wake Up, We're Going Home. Robin is a survivor of multiple brain injuries and PTSD. The resulting life lessons afforded opportunities of great insight, understanding, and ultimately led her to a spiritual awakening. Robin shares her story of transformation to offer knowledge and comfort as others are awakening to their own spiritual journeys, gifts, and divine life missions. Discovering her true self entailed a complete discarding of old beliefs that no longer served her, leading her to search for new truths. Now a thriver, Robin transformed into an inspirational writer. Make sure to visit her website at robinjbloom.com, and I will also put that in the chat room in just a moment. But for now, I'm going to bring on Robin. Are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, it's so good to have you here tonight, Robin. How are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. It's just a real pleasure to be here.
And it's a pleasure for us to have you here. So tell me exactly when your second book, Wake Up, We're Going Home, what was the release on that?
That actually came out in December of 2012.
That's what I was thinking. Okay. Okay. Well, why don't we start at the beginning before we jump to your sequel? I was just wondering when that had come out. I thought it was about that time, but I wasn't sure. In the opening, I talked about the fact that you had more than one episode of a TBI after your initial one. Would you mind telling the listeners, you know, I kind of like to start things at the beginning of your story. Tell us a little bit about your first injury, if you will, and then give us the circumstances of each of those injuries and, you know, the timetables.
Okay. Before I start, I'd like to just give a little bit of a background, if that's okay. Just
sure.
What life was like before TBI. Because I was a special ed teacher and a counselor, and I did work with special ed students, high school students, who also suffered with TBIs. I lived in the country, and I had two children. We lived in a small farm. We had cats, dogs, chickens, and horses. And I was one of those multitasking super moms who kept busy with many after-school events. I was furthering my career, going to night school. I was financially independent and relatively happy with my life. And then in November of 1996, while I was driving home from work, out of nowhere, a vehicle crosses into my lane and hits me head on. Yeah. I remember seeing headlights, hearing a screeching metal and glass breaking and spinning just wildly, and heard these words in my head very clearly. It was, "No one survives a head-on collision."
Wow.
And I was in and out at the time, but I do recall seeing this young male with blue eyes at the scene who was very comforting. I wasn't able to speak or move my body, and his voice was very gentle and soothing. And I don't know where he came from. I don't know where he disappeared to, and he wasn't with the ambulance crew, and no one else seems to remember him, but I felt a real deep sense of comfort and safety in his presence. And actually, it was his human touch that kept me connected at that time, especially since I remember an out-of-body experience that I had where I actually saw myself slumped over the steering wheel.
Wow.
And later, I learned separately from two intuitive friends that an angel was present at the scene of my accident. So.
Well, I have no doubt after an accident like that, that there was some divine intervention involved under the circumstances. So I don't find that surprising. Were you a particularly spiritual or religious person prior to your accidents happening?
I had a faith. I was a Catholic, so I did attend church. So I was more in religion at that time.
Okay, and we'll talk about the difference. When
okay.
we get to that, we will talk about the difference between religion and spirituality. But I was just curious. I don't want to give away any of our interview to the group here. So there were just some things that I know that raised a couple of curiosities for me, but we'll address those as as we go. So you were a special education teacher, and this terrible accident happens, and then what happened after the accident? Your recovery, what you remember besides that, the amount of time it took for your recovery, the extent of your injuries?
Oh, well, from the emergency room, doctors took x-rays and they ran tests, but they ended up sending me home with a shot for pain and a two-day absence from teaching.
Wow.
At the time, well, my TBI wasn't diagnosed for another 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time, my life was gone, but I didn't know it. I was in a fog. I was very dazed. I was confused. I remember feeling very alone, and I had this great mental and physical fatigue, and I never realized the energy that it takes to think until I had a brain injury. There was an excruciating head pain that lasted for months. So I remember that as far as some of the major ones, because I didn't really remember a lot of things. It's just highly distracted, but I didn't have the awareness at the time either.
Sure. Of course not. You probably just thought, like a lot of us, that you would heal. You got in a bad accident and something wasn't quite right, but hopefully it would go away and you'd snap out of it.
Well, I didn't understand why people were coming to the house. You know, it wasn't like I was dying or anything, and my thinking was I'd be going back to work. So I was completely clueless as to what was going on. And it wasn't clear, you know, because it wasn't diagnosed at the time. So it's just very confusing. But I never did return to work. So.
Okay. So you mentioned that you had multiple brain injury encounters, and so after this first one, I guess I'm just trying to get a little bit of an idea about a timetable. So basically, they just, like you said, and this is so common that it's sickening, but they checked you over, didn't figure anything was wrong, sent you home. Is it that you made the decision that you weren't ready to go back to work and didn't?
Well, what I started doing was I went to see a counselor because I had I couldn't function. I was just in a daze, and there was no way. I was a special ed teacher, and they were high school level students, and of course, you know, you had to keep sense of community there, or you'd have mutiny. So there was no way I could walk back in there. And so the counselor knew that something wasn't right, so I was sort of protected in that sense for those moments. But they didn't do neuropsychological testing until 6 months later. And really what warranted the intervention was the headaches. The headaches were so severe. I was just blown out of my mind. I mean, I've had migraines, but this kind of headache was just, it goes beyond words. It was just unbearable.
Yeah. I think a few of us know about those, so... when then was your net? We've got a number of people who listen to the show regularly who have had more than one after their initial TBI. When did your next incident come? How long after your first?
It was about 12 years later. It was actually 2008 was the second one. And it was a rear-end collision. It was in the summer of 2008, and ironically, it was while I was returning from a doctor's appointment. It was another impact, and I can remember hearing the explosion and dead silence, just like the first accident. And I remember being at the scene and being very confused, and I didn't know what to do, and I was very emotional. And the other driver was very apologetic, and actually, it was he who helped me exchange the necessary information. And I can remember him asking me if I was going to get out to look at my vehicle. And I was very perplexed. I just didn't have the awareness again. at the time, and I had didn't have the strength to even go to the emergency room or be seen, you know, immediately by a doctor. So we parted ways, and I drove. It was a 45-minute ride home, and actually I drove on the shoulder of the road.
Wow.
The second wasn't diagnosed until after the third one, even though I was seen, I guess it was about a week later, by one of my doctors. So the second one wasn't initially diagnosed either. So
you get in these two big car accidents, and, okay, I understand the first one. You did make it to the emergency room. They checked you out for leaks, didn't see anything obvious, sent you home. This time, are you saying you didn't even go? I mean, you guys didn't call the police or anything about that accident? You just drove home?
No,
on the shoulder of the road for 45 minutes? Is that what you're telling
okay,
us?
Well, I know from an outside point it looks bizarre, but when it occurred, I wasn't cognizant. I wasn't aware, and
right.
It was me alone in the vehicle. No, I didn't even have the wherewithal to call the police. I didn't have the wherewithal to get out of the car to look at the vehicle or to hand him whatever it was that he needed. And I remember calling a friend on the phone and explaining what had happened. And I said, did I do everything okay? Did I do what I was supposed to do? I was just not aware of it. And driving home was terrible. I was, again, in this kind of fog state. And I was concerned about driving.
Yeah.
And, of course, as soon as I got home, the first place I went was to bed. And I slept, I don't know for how long. And it wasn't until a week later until I was able to get in to see my doctor. But no, looking back, well, yeah, I should have done a lot of things, but I was in a state of mind, and I had no one advocating for me because, again, I looked okay. A doctor saw me a week later. He didn't say anything. And, of course, you know, I wasn't real talkative, but I didn't know, and neither did my family or the treating doctors.
Now, in the 10 years between your two incidences, you didn't go back to work. There was obviously something wrong. I would imagine if, and correct me if I'm wrong and fill in the blanks, but a lot of us who quote-unquote look normal after our family, because it's, you know, they've just gone through a trauma of their own, a different kind of trauma, and they'd like us to be normal since we look normal, because nobody quite knows what to say or do about these things. The caregivers and family members and friends, they don't get a manual, just like we don't, when it happens, of how you're supposed to act and what the protocol would be. But in that 10 years, your life changed. You had been a teacher for quite some time, and now you're not doing that, and you're having these bad headaches, and you are having residual symptoms. It's just that nobody's really, nobody has diagnosed them, but nobody, you were feeling them. You had diagnosed them to some degree. So you knew, or did you, that in that 10-year period in between, that your functioning, your thought process wasn't quite working the way it had before the accident. Like with me, I didn't catch on for a long time either, because I didn't get any of that advocacy, awareness, support, or any of that. But I had this feeling I didn't want to admit to myself that, you know, if you look at your brain like a computer, and let's say I had high-speed internet before, and now it was kind of like the old AOL dial-up line. Everything was going slower. Things that used to come to me quickly were coming to me more slowly. My short-term memory, you know, you could introduce yourself to me right now and tell me what your name is, and I would not remember it 5 minutes later. So, you know, my pile of residuals were subtle enough at first that I can see why you wouldn't. Heck, you had gone to the doctor and they said you were okay, right? You look normal and you want to be the old you, and the family and everybody, the friends want you to be the old you. And But still, I'm kind of curious in your case. I can't really tell you when exactly in my case the awareness came to me with full force. It might not have been until 17 years later, to tell you the truth, of truly the differences of the before and after. I guess I'm just a little curious about in that 10 years, your life had a major shift, but
well,
what was that like for you?
Well, it's just some insight, because for about the, it was about the first 10 years, I was very vulnerable. And like I had explained earlier, I wasn't aware of the effects of my limitations. And to describe it, to help you to understand, it was like being intoxicated and saying and doing things that you weren't aware of, and others were telling you about yourself, but you can't remember, let alone think that there was a part of you that you didn't even know or had no control over. You know,
so kind of like a blackout.
Well, it wasn't the awareness. In other words, the first injury, the major damage was to the frontal lobe, which is the portion of your brain in the forehead that oversees cognition. And cognition is how we make our decisions in life. For example, it's how we view our world. It's our self-awareness. It's how we plan, how we prioritize, how we organize things. It's paying attention, remembering details, also controlling our reactions. And in order to perform these mental tasks, the caveat here is that working memory is essential, because that working memory temporarily stores and holds on to that information to allow for processing.
Exactly. Well, so those are your executive powers.
Yes, the executive powers. So the combination of the impact from the collision, as well as the deployment of the airbag, those two forces is what did, you know, a lot of the damage.
Sure.
Or the, you know, with the injury. So,
right.
Of course, I had all those other things. I mean, I had the memory. Oh my gosh, it was so fleeting. I can remember grocery shopping, and it was so traumatic. I thought I was losing my mind, and yet that was a task that had to be done. You know, I had to take care of myself, but just getting a shopping cart and then taking the cart and moving it down the aisles, not knowing which aisle to go down, and then trying to figure out what's on the list, where is it on the list, how do you find it? It was just overwhelming. And that's just a small piece, but, I mean, there were a number of tasks that were just so difficult. It was just so overwhelming.
Right. I get that. I get that. So, yeah, I suppose with all of the things that go into those executive functions, that they were just kind of cropping up for you. That's funny about the grocery store. I had the same thing about the I still don't like grocery stores. I don't have the same issues in them as I did in the beginning, but it's kind of a feeling of dread when I walk in to a grocery store just because of the difficult times that I had in the very beginning. So it's interesting you'd use the grocery store. I wonder how many other people out there listening have the creeps in the grocery store, but I don't think the neon lights, you know, and the noise and the intercom and just the busyness help very much. It'd probably be better for me to go shopping in earplugs late at night when nobody was there, and I'm not even sure if that would help me very much. But so the frontal lobe damage, actually, from both of those accidents, the way your head would have jerked and your skull would have hit, they were probably both in the same neighborhood then, as far as the injury.
Well, yes, because your brain is still
lobe.
Moving forward and coming back. And I did have a diffuse injury, so, you know, it affected other aspects. With language, I've had challenges with reading and writing, speaking, listening, remembering, of course, and then learning new things, following directions, and also formulating my thoughts. I had difficulty asking questions, so it was hard to express my needs because I didn't know how to put it in question form. It would just come out so bluntly. And, of course, the difficult thing is that it's invisible. So even though family was aware that, yes, you did have this occurrence, but see, they were in denial. So they wanted the old me. And I understood, because I knew they loved me, but that was that was the best that they, you know, that it could be done at that time. But it was just very challenging.
Sure.
But I did end up becoming a student of my own skills, and I did this unknowingly because I would try different things to help myself. For example, I remember one day, because I enjoyed reading, but I couldn't read any longer because I had a visual perception problem. And with that, the words all jump around, the lines, and you cannot do visual tracking with it to be able to read, let alone get into what it is that you're reading. Because with the memory, if I turned a page, I forgot what was on the other page or who was what.
Right.
So that was even difficult. But I remember taking a card, an index card, and cutting out like a window that would just be for one line. So that was actually the beginning of how I taught myself how to read again. Now, a very slow process, but of course, we're talking, you know, a span here. It was about 15 years, I guess. But
right.
Anyway, and the other thing was I had trouble with an auditory processing deficit. So if the phone rang, you know, distractions are one thing because, you know, if you were doing something and had a distraction, what was before it was gone. You don't even remember as if someone else was living in the house. But with the telephone conversations, I realized that if I put on headsets, that the with the auditory processing deficit, I could hear more clearly and was able to understand some of what was going on. Now, sometimes the letters like a B would sound like the letter P, so the communication was still misconstrued, but it was
sure.
an attempt anyway to where I could at least start to focus. And to
that
be able
was,
to function.
Yeah, and that was good. You'd be surprised how much I hear. I had a guy on a couple weeks ago, and when we talk about self-training and those things that we do to compensate, you know, he had balance problems, and he went and started bowling. And at first it was it sounded like kind of those pads that they put up for the kids, you know, going down the lanes. And, you know, also always, it seems, a slow process. But eventually he got a great deal of his balance back from doing that, like you did with putting the cards, the slit in the cards. And you know, I would do things like that, too. The founder of our show, Craig, I remember one of the first nights I was listening to Brain Injury Radio, and I heard him talking about living in a world of Post-it notes. And the hair went up on the back of my neck, and I felt like a kid who got caught with her hand in the cookie jar. I thought, geez, I thought I was getting away with this all this time, and somebody knows my secret out there, you know. But I was doing a lot of that. And the other thing I would do a lot is what I called link. And if I could link something that was familiar to me and try to remember what that link was, and I wish I could even think of an example right now, but, you know, maybe with somebody's name and oddly, maybe what they look like and what they might have reminded me of, I might link it to something like that that was a lot more familiar, that was entrenched in my long-term memory to help me, be able to remember these things I was losing in the short-term memory. If there was a way I could lock it to something old and be able to get that recall, that actually worked sometimes. So I think it's interesting that a lot of us, that therapy we got was of our own making before we were even officially diagnosed, out of need and desperation. And I think that's terrible that has to be the case. You know, the way I put it is, you know, when your bell's been rung and you don't exactly know if you're on foot or horseback, that is an odd time to be taking on a new learning curve, you know, or playing a new game when you don't have the rules, you know, to the game board there. It's a very challenging time for everybody. But I know that one of the things that helped you, and I want to have you talk a little bit about it. In your case, it was horses, and in a lot of our cases out here, in my case, it's dogs. We have four dogs and a bird at our house, and I've often said that I think animals are more intuitive than people are a lot of times, and I know how I've experienced that, but tell me about your animal of choice and a little some of the circumstances around that.
Okay. Of course, I lived on a small farm, so I had animals. I was surrounded, and actually, they were the ones who I gravitated to first because the world was too fast and too overwhelming. It was just real easy to gravitate to them for their peaceful natures and so forth. But many days were spent in the pasture just being with my horses and sitting quietly. And actually, they would mirror unconditional love and acceptance for me, and they taught me about loving myself. They never turned me away, and of course, they didn't question my tears or forgetfulness, so I could release with them, even if I didn't know what was going on. And
right.
Every day, they were there, and they greeted me.
No judgment or expectations out of the animals, is there?
No, and that is really key to healing, because they were the ones who actually helped me to reintegrate within the world long before people. Recovery with my horses was a blessing. And I actually feel that they helped me with retraining my brain, with focusing especially, because I was so intrigued by how peaceful and loving that they were that I would just enjoy watching them. And I would often try to understand what motivated them, because I could see them in the herd and the dynamics with that, and then I would step into that dynamic. So I also, through their reflection, was being taught as well on some things like setting boundaries and some other skills just by the nature of the interaction. And then in time, this life started making sense again. I had a happy place, a refuge to go to.
Did you not even give lessons for a while? With your horses at a point?
I gave lessons before, because I had horses before the injury,
okay.
Because my dream was to have a therapeutic riding facility, because I work with individuals with disabilities, and I actually was a back rider and did that as a volunteer position. So I was wanting to incorporate that into summer, from teaching. I have summers off, so
right.
I would give lessons to students, and that's different people. So I had the background with the animals, but
right.
When I had my TBI, I actually had mares were having babies. So I was able to see the very beginnings of love with animals and being able to nurture that and to be able to actually get up on their back and so forth and have the trust and just the contact. Because love is just the basis of healing. Wherever the source is, and we all know how unconditional animals are, so it served me well.
Oh, yeah, me too. At the time mine happened, I had one dachshund, Frank, Furter, Frank, and, I got to say, still, he was the best nurse I ever had. He had been a pretty and always a loving, cuddly, like a lot of dachshunds are, but, he was also very independent and German, that German side of him. And when I was sick and down, 6-9 months, I wasn't doing so hot. He never left, he never left. He didn't want to go eat. He didn't want to go outside. He just wanted to be by me as if, protecting me or reassuring me, giving me comfort. And so, when you were talking about the horses in your book, even as well as this conversation, I've got to say that there's a lot to be said. And I agree completely that to be in a place where you have that confusion and you're trying to maybe perform well for others, including yourself, sometimes, at least I did, trying to go back to the old me, it was amazing to me that you know, Frank loved me the same. It was mm-hmm. like he didn't know a before and after. He loved me in the moment for what and who I was. And you're right. If more of those relationships could be replicated on a human level, it would be really nice. But one of the things, as you intimated, is that it can really inhibit our progress if we don't have those kind of relationships in our life, whether it's with our family, our friends, or some type of support group. So that really was a blessing that you had that experience and love for the animals before, and they were able to help you heal or at least feel okay about Robin when you were with them, even if it felt a little funny at other times. One of the situations you indicate was that after your accident, friends and family looked for the old you. You mentioned that in the beginning, and I wondered how that affected you, and if you could tell the readers, the listeners, a lot of the readers and listeners here know exactly what you're talking about, but it's something that it's hard to reconcile with your own family. People are all different, but how did that affect you, and what, if any, changes in relationships did you have with friends and family, and how did you cope with that? How did that make you feel?
Well, we often fear what we can't see or understand. And with the statement, many people are too afraid to face that fear. And so therefore they remain uninformed. And TBI is a death of sorts. And it's a death with its loneliness. It's often the biggest fear for many people.
Mm-hmm. And, for sure.
You know, even if I didn't completely understand what was happening, even amidst all this, I still needed to grieve the old me that died at the accident, and my family also needed to grieve as well. But I actually felt guilty witnessing their sorrow over the part of me that died, because I could see it in their eyes, and it's just so uncanny, because it was like I was attending my own funeral. I couldn't change what happened, but yet I still felt this sense of responsibility. And this was a very powerful experience, because it left me feeling very trapped inside. It was like being buried alive with nowhere to go and for the longest mm-hmm. time. And see, I didn't have the ability to express that to them, so it was all trapped inside.
Right.
Of course, you know what they want, but she's gone. She died.
Right.
So it's, you know, it is the acceptance, and it's the love. You know, and actually, to offer any kind of support in that situation, first and foremost, you know, if you want to help, is to just love and accept someone with a brain injury, you know, just as they are. Know that they're doing the best that they can, no matter what happens. That would have just really paved the way for an open heart to start healing.
I think, too, giving them a little caution on expectation, you know, would be good. A lot of us that I hear here, including myself, did have an emergency situation where our families told we weren't going to make it and mm-hmm. actually had last rites done over us. And hallelujah, it was a miracle when we got sewn up and got up and looked right. And like you say, they expected us to act the same. But, you know, we just talked about this last night. It makes me sick to hear you say it again, not in any critical way to you, but the situation, because last night, Les Paul, our Tuesday host, and I, we were talking about tools of recovery. And one of the things that I was talking about was all of the guilt and shame I felt for something I couldn't help. And the guilt that I couldn't go back and meet the expectations of others and myself by going back to being like the old me in the inside. You know, it was like it was a dirty trick for a while there. You know, I looked like the old mm-hmm. me on the outside, and the expectation was there. And I think, you know, one step further, after the doctors make the call either wrong in the beginning by misdiagnosing, like they did with you, or undiagnosing, let's say, or at the point where, you know, we have made it, some of us have made it to the hospital, and our families have been told we weren't going to make it. You know, they have that conversation. But one conversation that they don't have with me, with any patient, if there's one, call in later and tell me, I'll be surprised, but or the family, about expectations, you know, saying something like, you know, we thought, you know, your loved one wasn't going to make it. They did, but you might not want to put your expectations in a place that things are going to be exactly the way they were before, even if it doesn't appear obvious. That one sentence, to me, would take away a lot of the guilt and shame that I felt, because it would have validated that that was going to be coming. In some ways, I almost felt like it was my fault. I couldn't get well enough to be who I was before. And that's just crazy. But a bunch of us do that.
Well, that goes back to love and acceptance. And I think the big culprit here is fear. The fear is so great, and fear of the unknown is on both sides. Because I know my family loved me in the deepest and dearest of ways. They did the best that they could. But, you know, they didn't know what to do. They were scared. I know they wanted to support me, but they didn't know how to get past the fear and denial. And part of their fear was mine, that I projected onto them, because I didn't even know what to do with it either. So it is a very difficult situation, and it's on both sides. And really, the remedy is to love and accept. That's why, you know, just as a universal need, just love and accept whoever and whatever, where they are. But there's two sides to the coin. It's not only the brain injury, it is also the family, too. And that what's going to pull them together is that love and communication done with honesty. And you see this white elephant sitting in the middle of the room. Nobody wants to talk about it, but it's the fear that's there. And that needs to be resolved. So my thinking is, you hit that fear head on. You can ask questions like, in my case, what are you experiencing? How do you feel? Are you scared? And just that communication alone would dissolve the fear of separation, because I felt extremely isolated. And it would keep all the hearts connected, which would, again, allow for healing, not only for myself, but for my family as well.
I agree. I agree with that completely. I felt really bad one night. One of our new hosts, James, on Tuesday, he had, I think in his first show, the topic about, do people celebrate their day of rebirth, lives being saved, that type of thing. And he was talking about the big party that his family has, and some other people were calling in and talking about how they recognize that fateful day, or how they celebrate that day. And it kind of gave me a pang that night, all these years later, because we never talked about it again, ever. January 9th comes and goes, and I'm aware of it on my own, like I was aware of it during my recovery. And what was going on, it was like, and I thought about what James said after, and I thought, yeah, that's as much of a reason to celebrate as your original birthday, because it's like getting a bonus, you know, a second birthday, only this time you feel the pain. I guess a baby can't tell us, the mom does the first time around, but the second time we can sure as heck testify to the pain involved in this second rebirth, and to have that be something that's just never spoken about again. I think, you know, the fact that, and my parents, I could echo what you said, you know, my family and parents did the best they could, and like I said in the beginning, none of us got a rule book you know, coming out of this. And so everybody had their own tragedy going on, and everybody has, even with love and compassion in their heart, there's also an element of self-centered, and that fear, you know, not only, I think maybe it even goes both ways between the two groups, whether you're the survivor or a caregiver, and that's the fear, you know, of something happening again, the fear that no more progress will be made, but nobody really wants to talk about that or ask the question. So I think that that's good advice, but it's a hard dialogue. Sometimes people might need to go get help to get started with that, because it's not a comfortable conversation. And when you said that your family enabled you, as did mine and where I worked, I lost some friends that just didn't want to be around that. In fact, I got another sting not long ago. I got reacquainted with a friend. She had been my best friend from third grade until at 35 when I had my aneurysm and got married, which I always say on here, I don't recommend getting married right after a brain injury. Not a good idea. But I did it. And I remember her telling me when we got reacquainted, I don't know, 6 months, 8 months, 9 months back, I don't know, a ways back, that she was surprised that my first husband even married me because of what had happened with me. And, you know, this was someone who had been my best friend for that many years. And she was being honest. She said she didn't think if she were him that she could have. And it's interesting because it was after that, in that 35th year of mine where I had the aneurysm and got married, that I won't say she manufactured a reason, but our friendship ended. And it wasn't that I wanted that to happen. It's that it happened. And so, you know, a friendship that went that long went 17 years without being addressed again. And it was then, 17 years later, that she tells me, you know, we were reflecting on some things of the past, and she brought up that comment. And I thought, wow, do you even realize how hurtful that is? You know, one of the things one of our hosts always said is that we're people first. And some of these other compromises and challenges we have to go through are secondary to the fact that we're human first. But even if I thought that, I can't imagine saying that to someone, especially someone that you called yourself close to at one time. So, you know, I think you bring up a good point. You know, when people have love and tolerance and they're open-minded and they're willing to, have an open, honest dialogue, one of the recovery plans I'm in says, except when to do so would injure them or others. And I think sometimes if your family has always had a great dynamic, you can do it on your own. If it's been iffy here and there, it might be good to introduce a third party to help that dialogue get started in a healthy direction where you can nurture that love and acceptance that you're talking about. You can get the actual feelings, the real things about the fear and the shame and the blame and all the negativity. You can get that going, but without hurting someone worse by your answer. You know, sometimes there might be just maybe a little honesty that isn't exactly called for. It doesn't help a situation, and it only hurts it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Right.
But I think that's a good point.
Well, in my case, it ended up, you know, turning out very well, because for us it was a big lesson on unconditional love and forgiveness. So healing did occur. It just took some time to get there.
Sure. A statement in your book that struck me as important was, I think it went something like, the brain does not know what it does not know. What did you mean exactly by that?
Actually, the statement refers back to the lack of awareness that I had for about the first 10 years regarding the impact of TBI on my life. And it was when I was writing the book, I was trying to express it to people. You know, it's one thing to experience and have it within you, but to be able to translate it into writing sometimes gets very challenging. But if you lack the awareness that you've lost your cognitive function, you're not consciously aware of what's occurring because of the loss, which is the inability of the brain. It was the frontal lobe of my brain that was injured, and that's where the reasoning abilities, you know, how we make our decisions located. But, again, I wasn't aware of what was transpiring in the areas of cognition. So I would repeat questions, make impulsive decisions, and exercise poor judgment. And actually, I got into big trouble with that. And it was these vulnerabilities that I failed to recognize due to my injuries that were contributing factors to a number of incidents, including a serious spinal trauma. So again,
really?
It goes back to, I was completely clueless. And again, it goes back on the outside. I look like an ordinary person. So, of course, you know, family sees you as is, so it wasn't readily noticed by those close to me, and it wasn't, again, brought to the attention by my doctors. So not only did the brain not know what it didn't know, guess what? I didn't know what I didn't know either for a very long time. And that combination gets you into big trouble. I can remember my daughter she experienced all three of the injuries. You know, she was young at the time for the first one. 12 years later, two of them came within 3 weeks. She was in her 20s going to college and so forth. And she remembered, I remember her telling me that she was so concerned if she hadn't heard from me for a couple of days because she thought, you know, I may have burned down the house. And, you know, you could take that and just laugh at, oh, you know, burned down the house. No, because I did things. I know, I mean, burn cookbooks. I left burners on. But the memory was so fleeting. I would do a task, and it would, if I got disrupted or interrupted in some way, either visually or auditorily, phone rang, someone at the door, it was gone. And then, creates problems. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's the idea that the brain doesn't know what it doesn't know.
That's a good point. I never thought of putting it that way, but a couple of my listeners out there are probably chuckling about now. All winter long, one of the things I do to keep my voice is I drink a lot of green tea. Right now I'm drinking iced green tea because it is so hot I can't even remember. But we had the longest winter on the planet this year, and I'd go in and turn on my tea kettle, and all of a sudden the audience would hear it whistling. And it's because I forgot, and I call it something shiny. You know, when I forget something, I say, yep, I was in the middle of doing something, and then, something shiny over here, and I lost it. But I can't tell you how many times over the there's two things my audience in the chat room has been really, really good with me about, and I do say this with a lot of gratitude all the time for both me and my guests that we've got the best audience in the world on this program because they're very forgiving, because they're very understanding. But, you know, all winter long, they would say, Kim's green tea is done. They'd hear that whistling. I can't whistle anymore, but they heard that whistling going on in the background. And the other thing I do is I mute my mic a lot during the course of any of these given programs. You know, if I hear a plane coming in overhead, I'll mute my mic, and then something shiny, I'll take my eye off the ball, and I'll forget to unmute my mic. And one of my big jokes is that I say some of my most profound thoughts when I'm on mute, you know, but they'll type into my chat room, mic, and that's really all. They used to explain it in a sentence, and now all they have to do is say mic, and I'm like, and I click my button and unmute me, but I know exactly what you mean about that kind of thing, about the forgetting. So I don't blame your daughter for feeling that way. I've even found, and I've been married to my second husband. We got married so I could remember 05/05/05 at 5. So make this of 2005. So that I could remember, and he didn't know he wasn't, you know, it was a decade between my brain injury and when I met him. And I told him to the best of my ability what had happened. But see, at the time, I thought I was broken and got fixed, and that even the best neurosurgeon doesn't put Humpty back together as good as God created it in the first place. And so I had pretty much adjusted to, which is not to say I wasn't sometimes frustrated or angry, but, you know, a few years out, those feelings were more fleeting, and gratitude and acceptance were more out front. And so when I first met my husband and got to the conversation, you know, of telling him what had happened to me, there was really, well, not much comprehension more on my part than what I told him at the time. And he went on what I said. How many people out there, you know, never even knew what an aneurysm was until they had it or somebody else had it? And I really don't think it was until I wrote my book last year that he really fully understood, you know, what had happened. And so, you know, even now I catch him saying things to me. Are you sure the garage door was down? Are you sure, you know, did you get the burner turned off? And I don't know, sometimes I get a little annoyed with it, but I understand it because I do those things. You know, I still do those things. So there's an adjustment again in your family as your daughter. But now I want to go back because we missed talking about the third. The first was your first car accident, which did affect you and give you symptoms and changed your life forever, although you didn't maybe you fully absorb it at that time. But then you have the second accident, and are you saying that 3 weeks later there was another occurrence?
Yes, that's when the third one occurred. It was 3 weeks after the second one, and it was while I was riding my horse. But since it wasn't diagnosed, I had no idea. I was feeling better, and it was a good time to get out to ride because riding, I was an avid equestrian before my brain injury. So it's something that it feels very, I just enjoyable, very pleasurable. But we were working back and forth in the pasture, my horse and I, crossing back and forth like in a letter X, when I suddenly started feeling dizzy, and I had this sense of falling. And I can remember grabbing for the reins, and then there was total darkness. But what I find amazing in this is that somehow I returned my horse to his paddock. I took off his saddle and his bridle. I closed all the gates. I went into the house, but I don't have any memory of any of it. And then later...
So you did fall?
Well,
don't
I'm guessing I did because no one was there, and I just, later, I was just discovered by a family member. I was in my bed, and I was vomiting, so they took me to the hospital.
Okay.
So that was the second. So then, of course, you know, they did testing in that, and they confirmed that there was a brain injury from the first one that contributed to the second one.
Did they do that with neuropsych testing at that point, and it took them 10 years and 3 weeks to do that? Is that what you're saying?
No. I had neuropsych testing done 6 months after the initial TBI, and then because I had disability insurance, I, on a regular basis, I did neuropsych testing about every 2 years, so which is a grueling task.
Yes,
you know, to sit there for an entire day to be reminded of all those shortcomings that you have with functioning.
Right.
And,
seems like cruel and unusual punishment for the amount of time that it takes, not only the content of the test, but the amount of time for people who get easily fatigued and full basket syndrome with too many things being fired at you at once. I think that's the test. Not all the content that's in those tests, but the sheer torture of sitting there that long.
It is. It's a struggle. But, of course, you know, there are certain requirements in life, and, of course, I always feel that people do the best they can, regardless of who they are, what the situation is. So I approach it with a positive way, but in my case, it was actually used to establish the disability, if you will. So it wasn't used in my treatment because I never got any other treatment other than, you know, drug therapy initially and counseling. And so mm-hmm. it would be better understood if it served the purpose in the sense that I was developed, you know, a program for cognitive therapy or, you know. But anyway, that's an aside. It's just part of what it is. So
sure.
Just go on in life.
So you had that neuropsych testing in between. Now in between number one and number two. Now we're after number three, and I guess I was just intrigued, and maybe I don't know enough to know because I don't know. My brain doesn't know what my brain doesn't know. Let me throw that
uh-huh.
back at you. you said that they were able to tell. What kind of testing was done that they're able to tell what damage came from the first one that led to the second that contributed to the third? Is there a timeline in your imprinted in your brain on one of these machines? How do they know that stuff?
No, the second one, the first one happened 12 years later. The second and the third happened within 3 weeks of each other. They did the neuropsych test because they knew I was at the hospital. They took me to the emergency room, and so a neuropsych test was conducted. And based on the questioning that they did, they knew that my days and the fatigue and some other the symptoms that I had that I experienced from that rear-end collision, the second TBI. And then
right.
I had doctors that were treating me, and they just felt that, I think it was C1, C2, that there was misplacement there because of the head, I guess the trauma to the head,
mm-hmm.
which caused the syncope, which is fainting, which is what happened on the second TBI, which shut off the blood flow. And that's where the fainting came. So I was actually riding my horse and fainted and fell. I did have a helmet on, but you know, when you have a first TBI, there is a propensity for more TBIs, statistically.
Mm-hmm. Yes. They're getting more and more evidence to that effect. I hope they're letting the doctors know about that. I guess after 3 years, doctors kind of finally were catching on.
Well, it's like with any injury. If you think of a sports injury, it takes a while if you have a hamstring to heal, and then you have a propensity for re-injury to that hamstring. And that's just the nature of healing and so forth. But when you have an injury with the brain, yes, you still have a propensity, but the difference with that is that your brain is what, you know, the overseer of your functioning. So for me, it was like each time an occurrence of TBI happened, the lights were dimmed a little bit more. So
right.
It was very frightening, to say the least. But anyway, it did open doors for me, though. There were gifts in it, because at that point I started energy healing when my daughter came to visit. So, and that I attribute to a lot of my healing, which was outside of conventional medicine.
Okay, I'm going to make a note and have you tell me more about that. But let me get to your books for a minute. We don't want to put those aside. The first book, My Days of Brain Injury, and I just typed that in the chat room. And again, I've put your website in there a couple of times, but I'll go ahead and do it again, and we'll put that in. It's Robin J. Bloom, BLOOM.com, and I'll type that in just a minute, folks, but for you listeners, you just got it, and you'll be able to find out where her books are available, both of them. One place is, and I can't multitask here. Let me get you. Robin J. BLOOM.com. You find out there where you can find her books, as well as at Lash Publishing. Again, that's L A ilashpublishing.com, or if you're out there Googling, it's like eyelash, L-A-S-H. Just type in Lash Publishing, and you can find it there, as well as Robin's website, where her books are located. But in my days of brain injury, you indicate there were times you were very depressed to the point of wondering if death wouldn't be an easier way to end the pain. Yet you were able to come out of that and rebuild a life. Can you explain to the listeners the process of that transformation?
Yes. There's no doubt there was a part of me that wanted to jump off a bridge. But, you know, I was so consumed at the time with my injuries. And the other part of it is I don't even know if I could, you know, find the directions to get there. Nor the time to do so. So this is more or less, you know, the fleeting frustrations of having a brain injury and just feeling up against the wall. But of course, you know, having children and family, I never really would have followed through. But in looking back, the key to my transformation was self-love, which is total love and acceptance of myself. What got me there was hitting bottom time and time again, and realizing that my life was never going to be the same, especially as I once knew it, and it had drastically changed some time ago. It was time to find a new way to live. So I learned to rely on myself to find love and forgiveness and to surrender my fears. And of course, you know, I speak of it fairly easily, but this all occurred in a process over time. I rebuilt my life really moment by moment and slowly refilling that cup of worthiness. And in the beginning, it took a great deal of commitment and patience, but as time went on, my heart began to soften and reopen, and the process of loving myself became easier. And it was easier to love others than it was to love myself. So I would ask myself the question, I'd say, well, would you treat another person the same way you're treating yourself? So that was just a little gauge for me, sort of a benchmark to reflect back on. And if I wouldn't treat another the way that I was treating myself, well, then there was the insight, so I needed to correct that. And basically, you know, that was a guide to balance the love for myself, which really brought me back. It's very powerful.
Okay, so okay, good. So your transformation, I think, isn't unfamiliar to a lot of us at the point. I say that the program in my program notes, and then I try to remember to say it on air sometimes, is, you know, this one of the things I focus on in this program are the four A's: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. And, you know, the awareness, as you said, my four A's represent a process of recovery, not an event of recovery. It doesn't happen in a day. It doesn't happen overnight. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen with that magic shrink appointment or neuro appointment or pill that they throw at you. It's actually a process, and we were also talking about that on another show the other night, that, you know, a lot of times when we're having that expectation and we haven't fully come to acceptance about needing to let go of that old me and put positive action in place that is going to bring us into feeling comfortable in the new me, that is a very lonely, isolating time, because it's hard to explain that to someone else, even if you've got your kind, loving, accepting family, parents, support, well, I'll leave support group out, but the people who haven't walked in your moccasins, that don't know how that process works, it's a difficult thing to be able to describe, and that can be a really lonely time. At least I know it was for me, as you're saying in your book, you know, there was a period of time that I didn't know if I was ever going to be able to adjust or accept, you know, that I couldn't go back and be who I was, and was it going to be even worth trying to move forward, especially when I felt so tired, you know, mentally and physically fatigued all the time. It just seemed like it was going to take more energy than I would have of my own to be able to go through the actions to get into that new me. And with me, and I say that in the program notes, it became about the we, not the me, that got me into the new me. And that had to do with the spirituality that we'll talk about soon, and a supportive environment, which didn't happen to be a brain injury environment at the time. We didn't have anything like that in 1995, and we still don't in 2013 here in my area. So I guess they're still cutting out 3x5 cards and using post-it notes here in the heartland. But in any case, hopefully shows like this and books like yours, interviews like this, shows like Brain Injury Radio are going to help people understand the reality of what's behind that normal look and face, you know, is sometimes, and we're hard on ourselves. A lot of times we compare, you know, our insides with somebody else's outsides. They look like they have it all together, and we feel like we're a little rat in a maze on the inside, bumping into walls and not really knowing where we're going. And we look at all these other people that look so shiny and polished, and I used to be one of those. And, you know, and that's a mistake, because, you know, those people have their stuff too that we might not see. And so if we're going to cut ourselves that piece of understanding, I think we need to be willing to do that with others as well, and know that we're not terminally unique, that those kind of things happen to people in a lot of different contexts, but especially the brain injury community. But you and I never would have got a chance to know that, you know, because we didn't have that access immediately. You didn't have support groups for TBI coming out of the box, did you?
No, other than my animals, that's what I naturally gravitated to.
Right, but no association, support group, or alliance, or foundation, or your doctor didn't turn you on to peer-to-peer support of other people who had survived the same kind of thing that might be able to give you comfort and understanding and identification. No, I didn't hear any of that stuff either. Are you listening out there, professionals?
No, but, you know, that's sort of the protocol, too, with conventional medicine, because they just treat the symptoms. They prescribe the medication. I just know firsthand, and I look at it openly because, again, it goes back to, I think, you know, the professionals that I work with were doing the best they could. They go to school for medicine, and of course, they treat symptoms. They don't really go to the cause, and that's the protocol, and I understood it, but for me, that didn't work. I had sensitivity, and it never addressed well-being, but anyway, it's very involved. So it's, you know, brain injury is a marathon. And a lot of things, you are left to your own devices.
Right.
And it is like an explosion. And you have a choice to either, you know, rebuild your life or you succumb to the explosion.
Right.
I mean, it is, you know. So.
Yep, that's what I said last night. I think a lot of people get stuck in that second A of acceptance, and they just aren't able to accept and just don't have the energy or the wherewithal or the know-how to do those positive actions, and that's where we lose them. And so we're blessed to be here, that we came to that acceptance and took those actions, because some people just can't.
Yes, well, I agree with you, because there was a reason I lived, and I always felt that life was sacred. And so I was going to make the best of my situation, no matter, I mean, there were times I felt like I was crawling, and that's just what it was. But how I overcame that was I understood how fear and love works, and it was the fear that was keeping me trapped and resisting. And once I let go and accepted, the love came through, So that new me, I learned to embrace her. I learned to love whatever gift she had to offer me. And that's the way I look at it, because that's part of integration. The more you dislike of that aspect, you're disliking yourself. So, I mean, it is part of a transition, and it does take time, but the way I looked at it was, hey, if we're in this together, we better get along, we better figure something out, and that's just what I did.
Exactly.
I'm gonna love her.
Yeah. With me, fear, I felt like, was the absence of faith. If I had complete faith in that power that spared my life, I was going to have to try to overcome my fear with faith that there was a reason, and that I didn't necessarily have to know what it was, understand it, approve of it. That part really wasn't my business, the way I saw it. The way I saw it is I needed to practice faith by being open to things that were going to be placed in front of me, and then act on it and not second guess it, which brings me to my next question with you, because it's related to what I was just talking about, and I think we might have traveled a similar path in a slightly different way, but you indicated that your TBI has led to a spiritual awakening, and how would you define that?
Well, the spiritual awakening is what happens from all the fear and all the sadness and the trauma and the pain and the suffering that you endured, because what that does is it teaches you all those opposite aspects of love, and it opens the heart and it helps with the healing. You have to discard some of the things that you believe and find new truth. It's things like, the thinking that, I guess, money buys you happiness. That's something that would come from the brain or the mind. And the new truths are things that are more aligned with your heart, such as happiness comes from within. So it's a different paradigm of thinking. You are guided by what's inside of you and what feels right. It's more of an intuition.
Right.
Actually, when my brain lost partial functioning, it was no longer the primary vessel through which I processed information because of the brain injury. So as a means to compensate, I had to rely on my heart, and I intuitively felt my way through life rather than relying on old ways of logic and past experiences. You know, in other words, things that the brain would process, like recalling information or giving directions. So instead, I listened to my intuition and inner wisdom, and through my thoughts, my ideas, my visions, and feelings. And that's how I was able to look at my life differently.
Right. For me, I called that, I use acronyms a lot. The people who listen to me on here know I use a lot of acronyms, and how is one of them. I needed to come to that place you're talking about with honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness to go through those motions. And so to go a little further, I know mine, but you're my guest tonight, and they hear me talk all the time, but tell me a little bit about, I know letting go of old ideas, but the difference, as you would describe it, between that religious girl before any of these events happened and the spiritual woman here now, are those mutually exclusive? Have you found a way to blend them? But still, how would you differentiate, because you were just Catholic before the accident and spiritual and using energy work, which I want to talk about in a few minutes too. Those are a little bit different. Some people describe themselves in terms of the name of a religious label, and the people who say they're spiritual usually have something a little bit different in mind, whether they're attached to an organized religion or not. So just tell me a little more about your spirituality.
Okay, well,
how do you practice that?
Well, it's just it's just a belief. It's very simple. It's four letters. It's L-O-V-E. It's love. It is that simple. It's just a belief in a higher power that there exists a love greater than all of us. It's called different names. You know, you can call it God. You can call it source energy. You can call it the universe. You can call it whatever you want. It's not organized religion, per se, where they have the dogma of the church, which is the rules. Because I no longer, after this experience, I don't subscribe to that. I don't believe in things like sin, if you will. I believe we learn lessons in life, and we're here to experience the many possibilities of love in life, no matter how traumatic, because there are gifts and tragedy. So I don't see it the same way. What attracted me to the church was the teachings of Jesus as far as love and compassion. So it's still the same love and compassion, but it just doesn't have the organized aspect with rules and people that are in positions that self-serve or that instill guilt or other kinds of ways. So it's just that difference. So it's more open and it's free and it's true. You know, it's love. It comes from the heart.
Yeah, I agree and concur completely and couldn't have said it better myself. You state tragedy, my greatest teacher, opened doors to happiness I never suspected. What are some of the ways that your TBI has changed your life in a positive way?
Well, what I've come to know is that after a lesson or a challenging event in my life, initially I would pass through it and process the event, and that would, you know, that's the healing that goes on. And then there would be a turning back to gather up all that wisdom. And all the occurrences of my TBI and, you know, the spinal traumas that I had in my life, they all helped to strengthen my faith. And this goes back to knowing that there exists a force of love greater than all of us, you know, a higher power, if you will. It taught me how to understand how we consciously create our reality, because we do that with our thoughts. We do it with our words, our feelings, and our behaviors, to love more deeply myself and others. And it also, I was able to find the courage to forgive and to become grateful, because, you know, one of the biggest lessons with having a brain injury is that everything we take for granted is a blessing. And it wasn't until my lost brain function that I saw the value of what the human brain does. Even me sitting here now, it's helped me to step into my power of writing and speaking. I had to relearn both to be able to express in that and to find my voice again. And what it culminated into is I answered the questions that I pondered really most of my life is, who am I? Why am I here? And what's the meaning of my life? And this all speaks to spiritual awakening. And it's my inner journey. And that's basically what's in the second book. Because, you know, I just found my happiness by reconnecting to my heart, to my soul, which is my true self, and to God, and bypassing my brain.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't working.
I agree with you completely, and I think one of the things for me that I had to come to grips with in the before and after is that I would forget sometimes. I think the most important thing, regardless of what you call it, is the understanding that you're not the higher power. You know, because we make the efforts in the therapy and the efforts to, you know, sometimes we forget, and it's so about me, you know, and not we, like what you're talking about, that you do need spiritual assistance and the physical assistance of supportive people around you or tools, you know, tools like the horses and that around you. So I do want to say real quick to those listening out there, I just have a couple more questions for Robin, and then we're going to open up the lines for any questions or comments. We've talked over what I promised her, so if you do have questions or comments, please call in now at 424-243-9540. Again, 424-243-9540. 440. And we're with Robin Bloom tonight. Check out her website at robinjbloom.com. It is in the chat room. Or certainly you can find her book at Lash Publishing as well. But if you'd like to drop her a line, thank her for being on the show, have any comments like that, certainly go to her website. In your second book, then, and I talked to you about this the other day, I told you that after going 17 years and it taking a book and being a radio host to get me where I am today, and I listen to people who are 1 or 2 years out and they're from a knowledge base about how the brain functions, they're light years ahead of me. And the protocol has changed for the doctors that happen to pick up on what's going on a little bit. And I was telling you that I could pretty much sit down if I had the time and write a second book that would pick up where the first one left off, because that changed my life. Now, you actually did it when you came out with this second book, Wake Up, and you spend a great deal of time talking about fear from your experience. What's the role of fear, and how did you overcome the many fearful circumstances after your TBIs? And then I would just add to that, in your second book, I'm assuming you were doing a little bit of picking up where you left off, because you told the first part of your story in that first book. Well, there was enough of a psychic change, I suppose, between the first book and the second book that you wrote. Tell us again a little bit about that fear associated with your TBI, and really, what was your impetus to write that second book?
Okay. That's a tall order.
Well, we'll start with the fear. We'll go a piece at a time.
Okay.
Let's talk about your second book and the fear aspect, and we'll talk about that.
Okay. Well, just in brief, the first book is about more of the physical traumas that I experienced, because there were just repeated traumas that I had to recover from. And as a result of all that suffering, I was able to tap into more of the inner wisdom, which led to the second book, because I still had something to say, and it was more of the spiritual aspects. From all the experiences, I understood that fear served a purpose. I knew it had to. Because why on earth would it be here? So I began to look at it, and fear actually motivates change. It's a catalyst.
Yes.
And anytime I felt discomfort, I knew that there was a message, because I was out of alignment with my heart. Because if you're in alignment with your heart, you can feel that love coming through, which is effortless and free. It's just a very beautiful feeling. I mean, if you ever see a young child, you can feel your heart fill up with love. It's the same kind of thing. So then I knew what that felt like. And remember, the brain wasn't working, so I was living from my heart where I feel things. So then the fear was teaching me that it was designed to bring about change. And then after the many years of suffering, I realized that the thoughts originated from either a state of love or fear. So this became a very simplified way of structuring my action, which is another gift of TBI. Because, you know, with TBI, you look for simplicity. I had a busy lifestyle before TBI, but after TBI, things are very simple. And actually, I enjoy them more so, because I am very peaceful. You know, my mind is quiet, and I can actually enjoy more of life. But I would begin my day with loving thoughts and feelings, and I began to see that more love was created. And in comparison to if I woke up in misery, then that misery would follow until I changed my thoughts to what I wanted to experience. You know,
exactly.
The saying that misery loves company. Well, okay, so I got smart, and I said, all right, well, we're going to become friends of sorts, you know, with my fears. And say, once you start understanding how fear works, it no longer is fearful. If you have, because it's the unknown. And once you get that piece of information, you have just diffused it. So fear no longer exists. So I understood it was an illusion. It was an illusion that served as a purpose. And I learned that unhappiness equates to an unwillingness to change. So
yes.
What did I do? Little by little, I began discarding my fearful thoughts, and I started replacing them with more positive and loving ones. And this meant, I mean, this was a big one. It meant I could alter my perceptions about my injuries and not have to live in fear any longer.
Yes.
So, and how that works is your experiences are what shapes your perceptions or your viewpoints in life. And
mm-hmm.
your perceptions are what determines your reality or your world. And we each create our own reality. Whether you realize it or not, you are creating your own world.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, if you're unhappy, the only one that can change it is you. But when you change your thoughts, you actually change your world. Well, these were big for me.
Mm-hmm.
So next after that, what I needed to do was accept my traumas. So I accepted all of them, and I actually loved them. Instead of, you know, being feared by them, I actually loved them and embraced them. And gradually, I started feeling better. And then happiness became possible in spite of all my injuries and all the poor prognoses that I was given. So, you
right.
know, I just think of this song as when you're smiling, the whole world begins to smile with you.
Yes.
you know, TBI or not, so I was going to have a quality of life regardless, and I found it.
Right. And that's what I call it is, you know, some people change the word survivor to thriver, and I say a life worth living, because, you know, if you're just alive and you're a survivor, but you're just alive and not
mm-hmm.
thriving, I think a key point for really people to take away from that comment you just made is when you take away something, a void is left. You've got to put something else in there, and that's what you were doing. You were taking out the negative fear and putting in positive love. But if you had just taken out the negative fear and you hadn't thought through or taken those actions, like your action of in the morning, you know, right when you wake up in
mm-hmm.
the morning, programming your mind to go to a good place and not a bad place, and smiling at people when you pass them in the parking lot, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
and even the old guy with the grumpy look on his face is, you know, going to see your smile lighting up, and in spite of himself, you know, you'll at least get a little grin most of the time, you know, if not a smile,
mm-hmm.
and it interrupts their negative pattern. And so I think there's a lot to what you have to say about that, and also, you know, a huge thing for people to remember, and that's when you take anything away, you leave a void, and you need to fill it with something. And, you know, some people on the shows go down one path, and they might be over-medicating or drinking or having some other kind of destructive behavior going on in that void, in a way to try to find what you're talking about. But that truly clouds the light of the spirit. And it's like being on a treadmill. You never truly get to go forward. You stay on the treadmill until your grip goes loose and you go flying off the back, like in the Fred Flintstone show. So when you take something out, you gotta have it back, put back in. And I think that's a great point that you made, and everybody to take a note of as you're making a change. There's that old saying, when one door closes, another opens. Well, sometimes you got to be the one to turn the knob on both of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's taking personal responsibility for your happiness.
Yes.
Because I was consciously aware of what I was creating. And by taking that position, it was the difference between being a victim or a victor. So I actually see myself as a TBI victor. Because I was able to cross into that by just making those choices. And the idea that we're here, we do have free will. And we can be in that position to do that. We can have a meaningful life. Why not? We're deserving, regardless
right.
of
well,
what circumstances.
And I think you said, you know, the truth. You know, we got a second chance to try this. I don't think that God did that so we could come back and be miserable for some amount of years until we're done. I think there is a mission statement there, and it doesn't have to be grandiose. It might be simple, the thing you least suspect. I think sometimes people will be in this situation and they'll expect that they were saved for some huge, huge transition that's going to be so dynamic, it's going to move the world, you know, and it isn't always about that. Sometimes, you know, I've had people ask me about the book writing, and I'm sure you have if you don't plan on it, but, you know, you're going to have people that have written survivor stories like this, or any book, really, and they're people who are otherwise unknown, meaning they weren't celebrities, you know, that, mm-hmm. that went through this, and, you know, people want to read, and the big publishing companies, you know, want to go after those people because they play on the credibility factor, and sometimes these stories aren't heard, and that's why I'm blessed to be able to, I'm happy and blessed that you're a guest on my show tonight, and that I have the kind of show where, well, I won't call you a regular person, but somebody who's not mm-hmm. a celebrity at the moment, mm-hmm. You know, is able to share their story, because it's relatable when the celebrities tell it, certainly, but, you know, the humility place that a non-celebrity comes from, I think sometimes, not that they're not humbled by these events, but I just think it's a lot more profound. People, just like in a survivor recovery group, there's some identification and relatability. I think that's even more so in stories of regular people, than the million-dollar bestsellers out there. So I guess I would tell any survivors out there, and you might have something different to tell them, but, you know, if one of your bucket list items or one of your mission statements that's been presented to you after you've gone through your trauma is to write a book, don't let your motive be being on the New York Times bestseller list, because what's going to happen is that you're going to touch some people. They're going to get the message that was transmuted to you when you wrote it down, and the people that need to hear it are going to. And whether that's one person or 100 people or 1,000 or 100,000 or 1,000,000 people, the people who need to hear it are going to, and we do it because of the message we were given to carry and not for the money we hope to make by writing a bestseller. And I say that a lot because that's one of the things I get a lot, especially from the newer authors who come in and they're excited like we all were. You know, we didn't even think we'd be alive, let alone writing a book, you know. And when we get that first box or show up on Amazon the first time, you know, that's a jump up and down exciting day, certainly, you know, because we never knew we'd be here. We never knew we'd even be doing this. We talked about this the other night on a show, too, and I said, as a matter of fact, just today to somebody, if you would have told me, because I handed her a business card, and it says something different than what my business card for 25 years said, and I handed it to her, and she looked and made a couple of comments, and things change, you know. Our mission statement changes. And I think, like I say, that the message is heard. We're imparted with some messages that are supposed to be told, and the people that need to hear them are going to hear them. And so I think purpose sometimes we might build up in our mind with an unrealistic expectation. On the other hand, there's the why and the why not. You know, so you never really know for sure, but congratulations for following through and doing that second book of yours and expanding the thoughts that were in your first, because you know, you change and you get these new awakenings as you go along. I know that I certainly have in the last year and a half, and you know, you actually did it again and sat down and went through the process, and I think that's just wonderful. I do have one question on the board, and I think, you know, I had told you that I wouldn't keep you past an hour. We're at about an hour and a half. One thing I'm hoping that you address in your book, and then we'll just give people another good reason to buy your book, and we won't discuss it here, is the energy work and the out-of-body experience. I'm assuming that you would be talking about those things in your books?
Well, the energy work, the out-of-body experience was at the first accident, so I don't bring that back up again. But the alternative therapies that I used, because I couldn't fit into the model of conventional medicine, were I did yoga, meditation, craniosacral therapy, and energy healing. And the energy healing I would do on a regular basis, and that was from 2008, and I made strides from that period. And it did more than just the healing itself, because it's intelligent energy that goes where it needs to go. And it's ancient, so it isn't something that was just in, you know, just around. It's been around for centuries and so forth. But it put me in a position that I was giving input and a part of my healing, because I had relied outside of myself for others to fix me, if you will. And it didn't fit in it, because they never addressed my well-being. That was the big issue.
Yeah.
And I was never one to lay on the couch or to be heavily medicated and miss life.
Mm-hmm.
So their truth wasn't my truth. I understood that they did the best they could and they had those trainings and so forth, but it didn't work for me. So I went outside of that and I started researching, and I found, like I said, the yoga, the meditation, and the energy healing, and I found inner peace from it all, and I began to heal.
Hmm. Yeah, I think more and more we're going to be moving to more of an integrative type medicine, because I experienced that to myself, and I hear a lot of that in the audience. I get cranial sacral work done and energy work done regularly, because the throwing of the pills at me in the beginning, first of all, they didn't help what I was having an issue with, and second of all, a couple of them gave me new problems, which required a new pill to fix. And so I saw what road that was going to go down, and I didn't want to be there either, and that forced me out in the market and had acupuncture, acupressure, cranial sacral, emotional freedom technique, dialectic behavior therapy. I just kept going and going and going and going until, you know, I could find a combination. And I think, you know, that's another thing, you mentioning it, me mentioning it, is not to be afraid to try some new things or to feel too defeated. You know, the first couple times they throw a pill at you, I know you hope that first pill is going to fix it all. When you find out it isn't, you know, and they toss the next one or two, and that doesn't fix it all. You know, it is discouraging, and I'm not telling you not to feel a real feeling. Feel discouraged, but then get up and move on, and there's some other alternatives out there. And as you said, they have a lot more time under their belt than some of these new medications that are getting tossed out. The ones that you see on TV right now are new. Those aren't old pharmaceuticals, you know. If they used some of the old pharmaceuticals that the patent has run out on, you know, maybe they would have been even a little more effective. I'm not saying they would, but I mean, the stuff that's out now is stuff that's hot off the press. The energy work you're talking about has been around for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And it doesn't hurt to try. You know, the acupuncture did some good for me for a while, and then I found that the cranial work actually does the best for me. And we don't have an outlet here for the H-bot, you know, the hyperbaric, which I'm hearing a lot about right now from survivors, that they're perceiving that they're finding a lot of success in that kind of treatment. And so that's another perk of getting to be a host here is I get to hear, you know, some of the new things that people are trying. And I appreciate that, and I'm sure our audience does too, and gives them the courage to step out and try a new thing. You know, the days from when at least my 93-year-old grandma, still alive, thinks that doctors are gods and they do no wrong. What you said is they do their best according to their training. But that isn't the big picture a lot of times. And there was a lot of people groomed to stop at that point, you know, and think that anything outside traditional medicine was hocus pocus, you know, and a lot of that was about politics, you know, and the AMA putting a kibosh on some of that stuff. I remember early on, years ago, chelation therapy was something that was a well thought of by everyone but the AMA, alternative treatment, and it was just kind of an internal detoxing with vitamins and nutrients that would kind of help people, particularly like with cancer, do a little bounce back from the damage that their treatments were doing, not the disease so much, but the treatments that they were getting. And I remember a doctor that I went to was providing that, and the AMA came in like a SWAT team and told him that he had to stop the practice of chelation or they'd close his clinic. And he was a real MD doctor. He had worked in family practice for, I don't know, a zillion years, and then had switched over to psychiatry. And so he was legit on that side of the office. But on the other side, he believed, his mindset was just such that even though he came up in a scientific environment, he believed in alternative treatments and integrative medicine and nutrition and all of those things. And they told him no. They'd end his whole career if he didn't shut that alternative treatment down. So I think a lot of times the doctors, even if they're willing and open-minded, are afraid to say so because it jeopardizes their jockeying point, whether personally they think that or as a group, you know, through what's dictated through the AMA. So a lot of times now you're finding these alternative treatments in chiropractic offices, I know, have a lot of them. And a lot of the energy workers that I meet with are renting space out of a chiropractic office if they don't have an office of their own where they have kind of a smorgasbord of alternative treatments. But I feel really blessed that we have those options these days. And so I'm glad that you bring that up in your talks and in your books, that there's not just one way. There's not a magic bullet for all of us, I guess. And if you have a moment, I do have a question on the board, and then I'll prepare to let you go. I appreciate the time that you've spent with me tonight, Robin. I said an hour, and we're going on two. So if you'll be kind enough to just take one question or comment,
sure.
I'll see that we can get you out of here in time to get a good night. Sleep. And I believe
time.
This is
Thank you.
Who I was talking about earlier. This is our Southern gentleman, our Tuesday night host from South Carolina, Les Paul Morgan, isn't
it's
it?
It's me. And
okay.
You caught me while I was and I was actually shopping in Kroger's grocery store tonight. When I started listening to the show, I'd lost track of what time it was, and I was in there shopping and said, oh boy, and I just dialed in and listened the whole time. And I heard you talking about not liking to go grocery shopping.
Oh, no, you were in the grocery store while we were talking about it.
It was funny. I got very tickled. So it's very nice to meet you. I've been listening the whole time. I couldn't listen to every single thing, but it's been a very good interview. I appreciate you coming on tonight.
Thank you.
Had a question. I'm forgetting what it was. Oh, man. I might have typed it up here. Let me see. I'm a traumatic brain injury survivor myself.
Yeah.
I was listening to something you said. It was so wonderful. Now I forgot it. But your whole interview as a whole has just been wonderful. There are so many people that need to hear what you've been talking about. And like Kim was talking about cranial sacral therapy that she has, there's so many therapies out there that people don't know about that need to know about them, or the hyperbaric oxygen she was just talking about. What we're trying to do with these shows is to open up the door and let the people come through that don't know about things. And, oh, I know what I was typing earlier. It's up at the top now because I've been typing for a while. I was thinking about, I was just listening to what you were both saying, and I was thinking the power of one, and I typed that on here somewhere. What I meant by that is you were talking about how everybody has their place in the world, and we often, after a brain injury or any disability, but especially brain injuries, we feel like we're walking on shallow ground or and very, you know, new grounds where we're afraid to try this and afraid to try that. And when you meet a new survivor, they're, well, I've only been recovered for 4 months and I barely know where I'm at, that kind of thing. But I'll use today as an example. I was at this meeting, and there were several people talking, and one person changed the entire meeting. And we all have that power of one in us, because this one person brought up a subject that was really important about brain injury and survivors, and it changed the whole attitude of the whole meeting, and they weren't talking about this earlier. I'm not going to say what the subject was, but it changed the whole thing because that person was there. If I wasn't here, if you weren't here tonight, it would change the course of history. And that's what I meant by the power of one. And I got that out of what you've been telling tonight, believe it or not. I have some crazy ways of coming up with ideas. I was just listening to what you were talking about. I appreciate all you've been talking about tonight.
I thank you for that. Because, you know, we are inspired. When you suffer in such a way, you do not wish to see others suffer. And
yes,
if I would have had my book at that time, I would have been so grateful, but I didn't. So I am so dedicated to give back to others now that they have a resource and that they can prosper as a person, you know, and find meaning and happiness again.
That's wonderful. And one thing I tell in our local support groups and on Brain Injury Radio, you might be the next best person in the world to do something despite having a brain injury. Just because you have the label brain injury attached to you, I'm always talking about people first language. We're a person first, not a disability. People need to address people with brain injuries and any disability as if they're a person before they just are, hi, disability, how are you doing today? You know, I'm going to control your life because you don't know how. When you think of yourself as a person first, you address the person, you look at them, say, hi, Mr. Morgan, or hi, whoever in the world it is, and how can I help you, or how can we work together? And that fits into what you've been talking about tonight.
Right, I agree wholeheartedly. TBI is the experience; it doesn't define the person.
That's right.
And
so
I think what you said. Yeah, I think what you said too about the power of one is that what happened. The rest of what, as Paul Harvey would say, and the rest of the story. You said one person took that room of people and changed the course. Well, that one voice actually collectively became one voice, because that one voice was able to change a room of however many other people that were there to come and listen to that message. And
exactly.
If they were convinced, then suddenly that one voice isn't a solitary voice. It's a cumulative voice of people saying the same thing. And that's where I think we're going to find the power to change, to make this change that we're talking about and help people understand brain injury better. So I appreciate your comments and your calling in, Les Paul. And I'm going to wind it up with Robin. This is a 3-hour show tonight, so you guys don't have to call in to stay if you want to hear the casual chat after and some of our great indie music artists, but Robin's been more than gracious in staying an hour longer than what I told her she would be, but you've just had so many good things to say, and I don't know, a book an hour. I think if you're going to keep writing books like that, you know, you're going to have to get used to these longer interviews.
Well, I sure appreciate hearing you tonight. Nice meeting you.
Thank you, and it was nice for your comment and to meet you as well, Les. I appreciate it as well.
You're welcome.
Cool. Well, okay, Robin. Again, my guest tonight is Robin J. Bloom, and her website is robinjbloom, BLOOM.com. You can find out about Robin, more about Robin, and her books and where they can be purchased. And certainly check it out on Lash Publishing as well. And is there any final word you'd like to leave us with, or...
Sure. I just want to thank you, Kim, very much for the opportunity to share my story and to wish, you know, many blessings to all for your love and support in helping others, especially those with TBI. And in closing, if I just leave with four words, is to, you know, remember to be happy.
Yeah, that's a great way to leave us. Thank you so much for being on, Robin.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it, and we'll stay in touch.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Okay, everybody. Great interview with Robin. If you'd like to call in and chat about this interview or anything that might be on your mind tonight out there in brain injury world, please call in to 424-243-9540. Again, 424-243-9540. And I'm going to go get me a little more iced tea because the ice melted about an hour ago. Man, it is hot and humid in Nebraska tonight. So I'm going to give you 4 minutes and 45 seconds to get up, stretch, take a breath, get something fresh to drink, and then come back and either chat or listen to some good tunes. I'm going to, I usually say I'm going to close the show in my usual way, but tonight I booked my show a little bit different. Instead of booking at 2 and then going for 3, I just booked it for 3. So I'm not going to close my show with this, but I am going to end my interview tonight with Robin with this song. And it's something that a lot of you have grown to love and kind of become the theme of my show, but it's something that I believe that we all have. And that is A Guardian Angel. This is Guardian Angel by Leah West. Check her out at leahwest.com. And I'll see you back here in 4 minutes and 45. Thanks.
Softer love to guide you on your way.
West, LEAHWEST.com, and the song is Guardian Angel. Love, love, love that song. Two Saturdays ago, I think it was, not last Saturday, but the Saturday before, and I don't have a calendar with me. I bet there's a calendar in this magic smartphone that is yet smarter than I, but anyway, two Saturdays ago, we did a special show. One of our hosts was on away, and I got the chair that night, and we did a music tribute, a tribute to the indie musicians that allow me to play their music on my show. And it was pretty cool because it wasn't just the music, but the artists actually stopped by. And I got a note from a couple of them because, of course, I divined this idea 48 hours ahead when I found out that I was going to do that. Yeah, it might have been the 10th. Check around the 10th if you got a calendar out there. Anyway, some of the actual artists, quite a few of them. In fact, I should count up how many of them there were. I think I have about 17 or so in the stable now, and all but about five of them were able to stop in. And the three-hour show actually went 4 hours, but it was just some wonderful music and an opportunity. A lot of you regular listeners know that I give some backstory on the musicians and how I met them that I talk about when I play their music. And so it was really a special treat to be able to have that long 4-hour show where they were all popping in. There was even two of them that were on a tour doing a concert that actually called in between sets to talk to me and the audience of Brain Injury Radio, and I want to thank them again for doing that. It was just really a neat thing. I can't believe what a great group of people that they are. Not that I had any doubt that musicians were were a great group of people, but in any case, it was a really cool show. So if you're looking for something for background music some night that would be of interest to you, there's a wide variety of the types of music that got played that night and the music that I'm attracted to for the show. But I encourage you to check out that show in the on-demand section. Again, not last Saturday, but the one before, which I think might have been the 10th. And just put it on in the background when you're doing something else, and you'll get a chance to hear the actual artists come on and give their story about the songs. And we, several of them have gotten to be good friends of our show. I just heard from R.E. Moore today, and I feel like older than dirt and with a really bad memory that night, because there were two bands. The gal that I found, I'm going to play her in just a moment, R.E. Moore, that's A-U-R-Y. And as a matter of fact, we've kind of started a new practice that one of our hosts, Keith Anthony, started, and I think it's been a really good practice because, you know, whenever we hear, do a show, or a person writes a book, or does anything that they're putting all their heart and soul into, you always wonder, if it's having an impact, if it matters, if that's something that you should have been doing. And so, with artists, musicians these days, that's also a challenge. You know, when you see songs by people we consider to be famous musicians – being sold for $1.26 on iTunes, you got to sell a lot of songs by the time Amazon takes their 40% or 50% out, you know, to make a living being a musician these days. So I appreciate the fact that, these folks were willing to let us play their music and entertain the audience. And Ari was one of the first callers. Little history on her, just to show you about how much I didn't know. I guess I must have, I don't know, been in the disco ball or something during when some of these were popular. But Les Paul actually knew these bands, and a lot of you do too, I think. And Ari's sister is Pamela Moore, who was Queensryche. Is that right, Les?
Yeah.
Queensryche. Okay.
Yeah.
So some of you out there might be familiar with that band and Sister Pamela. And I believe it was her cousin who's Berlin. And I thought I hadn't heard of either of those bands, so I felt like a sheep because they seem to be older and older and famous. They seem to be, that's why I said I must have had my head in a disco ball. I don't know, but you know, the one Berlin did a song. Somebody typed in the chat room that night. They didn't say "Hey dummy," but you know, they said it was Top Gun in Top Gun. And let's see, is there anybody out there who can tell me what that song was? This is a test of the memory impaired audience out here.
You got me there.
I know. Well, there's other people in the chat room. If you think of it, type it in or call it in and tell me. But or look it up. Look it up for us. And it was, I don't know if it was the theme song, but obviously it was a big song in the movie Top Gun by Berlin, also a well-known group. But it's interesting how things work. I personally hadn't heard of either of those bands or didn't think I had. I did recognize the song from Top Gun, but when I found Ari, little sis, you know, she had definitely grown up with a strong musical background around her, so she certainly came up in the right place to find her stripes, that's for sure. And I was just texting with her a little bit today. It's been kind of cool for me as a host to not only meet friends out there in the audience and among my fellow hosts, but now these musicians as well. And you know, if I thought at one time that nobody understood and that people always had an agenda, you know, maybe a little negative or I wouldn't say paranoid. I looked at it as realistic at the time, to be honest with you. But this has been a very pleasurable learning curve for me to get to meet so many nice people in venues that I had never been before. And so I think that's pretty awesome. And Ari is one of those, and I think I'm going to play one of her songs.
Kim?
Please do.
I believe it's Take My Breath Away by Berlin.
It is. That's, ding, ding,
I,
ding,
I
ding.
Knew it was in my mind somewhere. That's
Jenny's
going to
be so
song.
Upset. She's going to be so upset she didn't get the rubber duck for tonight. I give out the rubber ducky for people who get these things right. And
I was
Paul
sitting here thinking, and the song just started playing in my head, and I'm thinking, oh, that's Berlin. It just comes back to me.
Take my breath away. I know, and see, when they said it, I liked that song, but I didn't happen to have it in my music collection when I was
younger. It's a beautiful
younger.
Song. I love it.
Yeah, it's good. I'm sorry, that's what I said that night, too. Yeah, it's good. But
I think it's great. I love it.
All right. Well, you know, to each his own, but I liked Ari. And not that that's mutually exclusive. As you're going to hear, we have a lot of really great artists working with us on the board and some new ones on the way, by the way. But I think I'm going to play tonight a song by Ari Moore called Wasting Time.
Thank you. Without waiting, waiting to the other side. My feet still reach the bottom. I will make it there this time. And I'm pushing my fear behind. I can touch it, I can taste it. I will make it there this time. And the weight won't bring me down. I'm done with wasting time. My resolve won't fail me now. I'm done with wasting time. Without breathing a new life inside of me, I have wrestled with my demons. I have set my spirit free. I have touched angel wings. I can be it, I believe it. Nothing conquers me, cause the weight won't bring me down. I'm done with wasting time. My resolve won't fail me now. Done with wasting time.
If any of you are out there on Facebook right now and you want to make somebody really happy, I put a link in the chat box, but if you're in Facebook, obviously, you're at facebook.com, type in, all like it's one word, AuryMooreBand, Ari Moore Band. And let her know that you heard her on Kim's show or on Brain Injury Radio, and tell her you like her. She did something kind of cute today. I'm going to buy a hoodie. I'm going to be a groupie. I've decided now that I have some musicians, I'm going to be a groupie. So Ari had some hoodies, and I got the coolest thing. Oh, you didn't find it there? What about just searching Ari Moore Band from Facebook. I think you'd be able to find it, or maybe just missed, because that's what I got here and where I found it. Ari Moore Band. Oh, maybe not too. Here, let's see if we can take one O out. In any case, I'll find that. I don't want to keep you going with that. But the other thing is, she does have a website, and that will tell you where to find all of her music. You can also leave messages there. And it's remoreband.com. Again, that's why I'm pretty sure that's what it is on Facebook, because there are two O's, AuryMoreBand.com. AuryMoreBand.com, and on Facebook, AuryMoreBand. And let her know that we appreciate hearing her. Anyway, another cool thing about her and the hoodie today was that she had a color chart. And my husband's actually the one that noticed it on the news feed. I'm only on Facebook a couple times a day. I don't have that stuff ring to my phone, Facebook and email and all that. I'd never get anything done, and I'd be in sensory overload all the time with that stuff. It would make me grumpy. So I need to, you know, Robin was talking about making life more simple, and for me, it's not more simple to have messages coming in from every quadrant and never stopping. So I need to practice my mindfulness by being able to try to focus on one thing at a time sometimes, maybe two or three, but not 15. So I'm just not evolved yet, you know, where I've got everything coming to my telephone. But my husband caught this swatch on the news feed, and it was probably, geez, I don't know, 25, 50 colors, and it's of these hoodies, and it was real cute. It was her own page, and she posted on it, everybody ignore this but Kim Justice, because we had been talking about it. I'm so glad my husband told me, because I didn't even know that existed. He was laughing about it. I said, what are you talking about? And so he showed me on his, and it's the different colors of these hoodies that she has, and it reminded me of something. In my younger years, before my brain injury, I was coming up at a time where Native American Indian jewelry was very popular. Thank you. I'll let them know that. Where it was very popular, and I worked in this jewelry store all through high school and college. And I'm sorry, I kind of lost it. Les Paul told me the truth, and I took my eye off the ball and did something shiny again, but it is, if you're on Facebook, it's Ari Moore Band, AuryMoore Band, so it is there. In any case, okay, the choices, the color choices. I don't know if you guys have this, but it was kind of funny. Same thing in the jewelry case. Yes, Native American jewelry. We had tons and tons and tons of this jewelry. And invariably, I would go in and people would want the jewelry I was wearing. And so it got to the point I had to quit wearing my own stuff and put on the store stuff, because people always wanted to buy it off me. Well, I realized one of the reasons was the same thing that happened to me today with all the color choices she gave me, is if somebody gives you two choices, it's easy. You pick A or B, right? You want blue or red. Neat, easy choice. You give somebody a palette of 25, 30 colors, and you're going to ruminate over. Now, let's see, how many things do I have that go with the purple? Let's see, I'm in Cornhusker territory. Should I get red? Gee, blue goes with my eyes. I mean, it was just ridiculous. I was on there like forever, and she was asking me about what color I wanted my husband's to be, because I already told her, you know, what I wanted and I was getting, but then I got all confused. Well, anyway, the same thing used to happen in the jewelry store, and I think it was the same principle. When people would look into the case, there would be so many different choices that then they'd look at me and see, you know, a necklace or a ring or a bracelet or something that looked good on me, so they figured it would look good on them, and so many of the sales were brought about by things that I was actually wearing, and I think it was because it limited the choices. Sometimes too many choices can really make you indecisive. You know, even if it's nice to have a lot of choices, sometimes it could just really ball you up. So I was on there, and that was my funny story about Ari for today. So God knows what colors I'm going to wind up getting after I made all the comments that I made about the different colors. And then I got hooked up on something, sapphire. Sapphire is blue. God, I was thinking of emerald. Okay, never mind. I totally screwed up her page today. Anyway, this is Brain Injury Radio, and I'm your host, Kim Justice. This might not be the time to be bringing that up after what I just said, but in any case, the boards are open, so if you have any questions or comments, please do call in to 424-243-9540. Had a wonderful guest tonight. If you're coming in late, it's Robin Bloom. Her website is robinjbloom.com. Do check out her two books. She's a wonderful lady and wonderful books, and I appreciated her being my guest. And now we're into a portion of the show where it's free chat. So some of you folks in the chat room must have something on your mind, burning on your mind, that you want to talk about. And if you do, or you're just out there in radio land, do give us a call, 424-243-9540. That's what I get for trying to do it too fast. I got another buddy who got that voice-to-text thing on the smartphone, and I think he's guilty of the same. He talks fast. And when you talk fast into that voice-to-text thing, it doesn't pick up a lot of what you're saying. And so some of the messages you get on your text are really funky. You know, it's like, what? After you read that? So I did get that option, but me, I get afraid of change sometimes. You know, when I get used to something, I forget to change. And I mean, not forget, I don't like change, and it's probably fear. You know, fear of change. I'm here and I know what I'm doing. I got to try something new. And you know, sometimes that's a really challenging thing. But in any case, again, I think it's this heat today. I even had an article, and I don't even know what I did with it. My brain is so fried today, I didn't even put the top down. I had the air conditioning on, and instead of driving my topless pony around, it was really hot. And I don't know about you guys out there, but at least a lot of people I've read on the social networking pages and myself have trouble in extreme temperatures, whether it's cold or extreme hot. You know, with me, the extreme cold brings on chronic pain issues and makes them flare. And the heat just drains me like letting the air out of a balloon fast. You know, I just get really, really tired, you know, and I have to be careful about that, cool off and drink plenty of water and do some things to kind of counterbalance those effects that, you know, that I get, and try to cover my head. Sounds silly, but, you know, there's something about baking my brains as I'm out there trying to garden, which I was really lame at this year, I have to admit. I have some beautiful gardens in my yard, and the weather was so weird for us, and I know a lot of you out there around your parts of the country, but first week in May, I remember sitting here talking to you guys, and we were calling for 2 to 4 inches of snow, and it was 30 degrees. And so the spring flowers that normally come up in April didn't. And so I felt like we missed a part of spring, and then we went into this weird season I can't describe, because it wasn't spring, because the things that you're used to seeing, the colors popping and the life coming back after, you know, the long Nebraska winter, that stuff was pretty much missing or very transient this year. And then it went straight into this season where the temperatures were great, have been great most of the time, like spring-like temperatures. And now I can't believe that we're almost to September when I feel like winter just ended. But I really don't have a lot of reason to complain. I'd say that we've probably had a week out of this whole summer so far where we've had these middle 90-degree temperatures with this real heavy humidity, but it sucks me dry, I'll tell you that. Reading a couple of things in the chat room, people agreeing that the heat really fatigues them and makes some of their symptoms flare. And so, you know, be careful out there. Try to maybe limit your time in the sun. Take an umbrella. You know, just think of those sometimes on a rainy day. But, you know, that'll keep the sun off your face and your head. Maybe wear a hat. Obviously, the vitamin D is good. I know a lot of us also suffer from depression and things like seasonal affective disorder. So finding that balance, you know, between staying inside and, you know, being a pasty ghost and going outside and getting a little color and drinking up a little sun and vitamin D to keep the spirits up, but you don't want to over-fry and, you know, hurt yourself, you know, either with fatigue or other symptoms coming up. And so I got me some very stylish ball caps that I put on when I'm out and about and incognito, and I find that helps a little bit, especially she was in 602. I think that's Arizona. Maybe I'm starting to kind of learn area codes from having done this for almost a year. I don't know them all by any means, but I think 602 might be Arizona-ish, Southwest-ish, and I bet it's been hot down in her place too. And this is a rough for some of us getting through this. But one of the things that she talked about earlier. Well, I'm going to wait a minute. So, Les Paul, what about you? You and the heat and the weather. Do you feel like barometric pressure changes and temperature extremes? Do you have problems? And for those of you that don't know, again, Les Paul is our Tuesday night host. Oh, and I want to say one other thing. I'm going to give you a chance to talk someday here, but I'm going to make all of your messages for you and then see what you have left to say. I thanked my two new programs, earlier programs in our new earlier platform, which would be 5 p.m. Pacific time. And I thanked Dr. Bob, who came on before my show tonight with his show, Shaken Not Stirred. He's the first, third, and fifth Wednesday of every month. And then on the second and fourth is Lori Purdy Fatel, and she has The Science of Happiness, also a wonderful show, and she comes on before me the second and fourth Tuesday. Now, on Thursday, in that 5 o'clock platform, Les Paul, who is staying, not to be confused, with his regular show, we've been doing about a year now, but his Tuesday show, Dream Catchers, is still going to be on at the regular time, but he's picking up a new responsibility, a love close to his heart because of his job, and it's a show that's going to be on Independent Living every Thursday night at 5 p.m. Pacific, and it's called The Empowerment Zone. And Les is going to be splitting that up. He's too important around here for us to let him get burned out. So we're not going to let him do all 4 weeks. He's going to be rotating with some very interesting and informed people on the subject that go back to the beginning of the civil rights movement for well, disability at the time, obviously, that's how it was being noted. But anyway, so tell me if you know, tell the audience a little bit. And after Les Paul, I want to say Fantastic Frank is on at our regular show time, which is 7 o'clock Pacific time. So right after Les Paul with the Empowerment Zone, is Fantastic Frank. So now I'm going to shut up for half a second if that's possible, and maybe you could tell us if you know what your show's going to, don't give it away, but just give us a little teaser of what you're going to talk about on your show tomorrow, and maybe make that the second question. And A would be, let's go back to the weather for a second, because I'm dying over here. You got these kind of effects from the variances in temperature?
Wow, have I. The weather has been, we've had so much rain here that it's just phenomenal. It's unbelievable. We've had, it seems like the entire nation's rain came to Aiken County in South Carolina and Augusta, Georgia, and the surrounding areas, because we've had far above normal rain. We had all the big lakes, and we have some very large lakes in our area, and all of them were far below normal for the past several years. Now they're above normal to the point they don't know what to do. The Army Corps of Engineers are trying to get it back down. I mean, we've had just unbelievable rain. It'll clear up. Today it was beautiful clouds and clear sky. And then I saw lightning coming out of the clouds while the sky was clear on the other side of the road. It was so strange. I tell you what, look at the sky and study it. It's, the strange things are going on in the sky. But I think of the clouds as skyships. I say that sometimes. It's amazing they can carry that gigantic amount of water and float above your head, you know, and shoot lightning at you. They're powerful things. I forgot your original question, though, by saying that. The humidity is just about knocked me out, because our air conditioning system where I work has been acting up, and we just got it straightened out this week, so it's been torture, but we love it
anyway.
Yeah,
it was mostly just about, Les Paul's had a couple aneurysms and AVM, TBIs, he's our smorgasbord of brain trauma host, he's had a little bit of all of it that he can speak to, and so the question was, you know, really like, you know, the if fatigue is one of your after effects, if pain is one of your after effects, you know, like whether it's migraines or some other kind of pain or whatever your residuals are, do you find that these temperature fluctuations make those more noticeable to you or have an effect on you?
I do. Yeah. And also you said barometric pressure a few minutes ago.
Yes.
I won't be paying attention to that, and I grew up loving science, and so I would study the weather and how barometric pressure affects things, how it pushes the clouds away or brings them in. And when the pressure drops or when it rises, I tend to have more headaches in between. It's kind of weird. Mm-hmm. I've noticed that about myself. On a really clear day with just, I said really clear, with a nice clear day with a few clouds, I don't seem to have as many headaches. I've noticed that. You ought to check your, if you suffer from migraines or head pains and things, kind of do a mental checkout about it. Because my mother always talked about, she would say, Les, it's going to rain. And I said, what do you mean? And she would say, I feel it in my joints and my legs and my bones.
Yeah.
And she would be right. She could predict the weather by her bones. She said, I know it's going to rain after a while. I don't care what the weatherman says. It's going to rain. And the weatherman would usually be wrong, and say it's going to be partially cloudy with no rain or very little chance of rain, and here comes a thunderstorm and a heavy downpour. And she would always laugh at the weatherman. She said, tell me that they know what they're saying. What did I say?
Yeah.
And this, sometimes it'd be the night before or early in the morning, and the rain would come several hours later. And so I believe the human body has its own barometer and temperature gauge that has to be watched more closely. I believe we're more in rhythm with nature than we realize, or out of rhythm with nature, should have said, because after a brain injury, you do become more out of rhythm within your natural surroundings.
Right. I think that's good for people to know, because it took me by surprise. I spent, you know, my early years, and I know it's frowned upon now, and when, you know, the ozone changed or the politics changed or whatever, and people, you know, quit sitting out in the sun. But I grew up in the day of the sun goddess. You know, we sat next to the pool and got brown as a berry, and that's just what you did in the summertime, you know. And boy, I can't handle that heat now. And it's funny you'd bring up what you did, because no wonder my husband likes you so much, and you guys haven't even, I don't know if you've even ever had a chance to say hi or talk, but
I've heard him in the background. I think we spoke afar one time.
Yeah, far away. He was in the Air Force for 20 years, and he did weather. That's what he did.
Okay.
And it was during Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and he was doing the weather for the planes that were flying in and out of the desert. And so, you know, when I will do my study of clouds, you know, a lot of you out there know I take pictures, and I take pictures of it was therapeutic for me, so I'd have to say originally I didn't like to take pictures of people. I liked to go out alone in an area outside the city and take pictures of nature, close up of flowers, you know, just whatever I found of interest. And lately when we've been going on road trips, we've had some really cool cloud patterns. And so I have him drive, and I sit in the driver's side, and I scope out these cool cloud formations and take pictures of them. So, you know, I'm calling those study of clouds, joking around when I post them on my page. But, you know, he tells me what each one of those clouds is called, you know, and knows all the terminology and the stuff in the background. And he and I go through the same thing that you and that your mom and the weatherman on TV go through. Gary will say, nah, it's not going to rain today. And I'll go, no, it is. It's probably, you know, it isn't going to be probably till after midnight, I bet, but it's going to rain. And no way. They're not even calling for any rain. And then, you know, it's storming in the middle of the night. And so we've had that thing go on more than once, too. And I think you're right. You know, the body is in tuned involuntarily to responding to weather conditions. And so if you're out there listening and you're new around these parts to your injury, and you notice that you feel worse or more tired or more of whatever your issues are afterward, you know, take a look at the weather. You know, if it's hot weather,
right.
And you know, you used to be somebody who would be outside all day riding your bike, gardening, you know, you could spend the whole day out in the heat and it never fazed you. That may well not be your reality anymore, you know, that you need to go in and cool off and really hydrate and wear a hat, which is not to say you don't get to get a farmer's tan or any of that stuff, but you just don't get to stay as long maybe as we used to. Or, you know, you might wind up being so tired, you know, the next couple days that you can't hardly get up and get dressed and function. I hate that.
You know, as an example, I just want to share a friend of mine who's a brain injury survivor has very significant brain injury. This person cannot tolerate heat at all. I mean, it's like it's messed up her what is it, the cooling system for the body. I mean, I've been around her and she said, I've got to go in, I'm about to melt, and it'll be just a little bit warm. Other days it'll be warmer, and I notice she can take it, but she has to be very, 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 very sensitive to the temperatures. And, I mean, to the point that she just goes, she'll turn around and say, I'm sorry, Les, I can't talk to you. I've got to go in. I've got to cool off. It's like her body can't sweat, and you have to perspire to be able to be able to cool your body down. It's your body's radiator, and this person, it affected their body's radiator, their cooling system. And her brain injury did that.
Yeah, well, I'm sure my brain injury did that. Although I don't have the problem not sweating, that's for sure. But I sit there and watch my dog. I just had a funny thought. It wasn't any affront to her, but I was just, you know, with my four dogs, I've been watching them outside today, and they're panting, and that's the way the dogs sweat. You know, is by panting. So I don't know if that would help your friend any, but they'd probably think she was kind of funny for doing that, you know. That was bad. And you got to forgive me. I got fried today. I got so hot today that I'm not even thinking right, but I was blessed to have a really good guest. And so I didn't have much opportunity to screw things up too bad earlier, but now it's kind of a grab bag sort of a thing. So what about the show? We've established that the weather does have effect on us, and so I'm just going to close that little piece of the comment with those of you that are again, that are out there that are new and you notice some changes. You know, one thing I see a lot on the social networking pages is fear, and rightly so. After some of the stuff that we've all been through before, when we feel one of those old familiar pangs and the panic sets in for a moment, you know, before you race into panic mode, which is even going to exacerbate those symptoms further, you know, look and see about simple things. I'm always drilling home, halt, hungry, angry, lonely, tired, temperature. Look at the temperature, too. Add another T, you know, to that, a double T, and take a look at the temperature. It might just be that you're overheated, you know, and maybe you didn't eat enough today. So, you know, the combination of being out in the heat and maybe not eating or not hydrating properly, will be something that'll cause you some grief. And it doesn't mean that the big one's coming again, Martha. Who used to say that? The big one's coming. It was like Sanford and Son or somebody
Fred
like that. Yeah, Fred Sanford would always say, the big one's coming. I can feel it. The big one's coming. You know, try to have a sense of humor around that fear a little bit and check and see if there isn't something maybe a little more simple that might be triggering those symptoms. I didn't know about the weather for a while, but now you all do. So what about this new program, the Empowerment Zone on Independent Living? Do you know what you're going to talk about tomorrow yet?
You've got me tickled. I forgot you asked me that. And I've got all my information on another computer, which isn't on, and I've been gone all day. So if I tried to tell you, it'd probably be all broken up. But the show's basic premise is about empowering people with disabilities to take charge of their lives again, because I mentioned the power of one with your guest a while ago. I believe the power of one is each one of us, and that's
yes.
what I was talking about when I mentioned that. And that's what we do at Independent Living Centers, is we teach people who are new survivors, just as I was taught by my supervisor and coworkers after I recovered from my brain injury, is that we are people of importance. We're people who have a meaning in life, and we want to be treated with respect and dignity just like everybody else does. And that's
that right.
people first language I mentioned so often. And because we are a person first, we're not a disability. And often people, after we have a disability, they look down at us and say, oh, you poor thing. We don't want a poor thing. We don't want a pity party. We want a fair handshake and a hand up, not a hand out.
Yeah.
I say that very often because people often look at people with disabilities saying, oh, look at them getting those benefits. Look at them. They want everything and don't want to do anything. No, we really want to do everything, and we can show you how to do it and save money at the same time, and we can show our federal government how to save money if they would just listen to some of the things that are going on. There's some of the things I'll be talking about is there's some authorization on the federal level coming up that will help independent living centers help people everywhere with disabilities, all disabilities, brain injuries, everything. And so I'm going to be talking about topics like that.
Super. Well, we'll be looking forward to that. Again, that's at 5 o'clock Pacific time tomorrow on Thursdays, every Thursday henceforth. The Empowerment Zone show will be on, so we will have a platform of programs. We're still filling in some, but we're going to be having a platform of programs at 5 o'clock Pacific, and then our regular platform is staying at 7 o'clock Pacific. And, oh, yeah, the reminder, when you go looking for us, we've had a few people write us and say they couldn't find our show here in the original block of shows. And what's happening is that they're putting the show that comes first. When you have multiple shows on in a day, the page that's there is the first show. And so now this new tier of shows, the page is on top of our show. And if you just look down right underneath the picture, there's a little arrow, a right-pointing arrow. I think there's a left one too, but forget about that. Little right-pointing arrow. And click on that, and it will turn that page or move that page away so that you can find our shows. We still are there where we've always been. We just have a new tier in front of us now, and that page is on top of ours. And so if you're looking for our upcoming shows on a certain date, or even as we get down the road further, I can see this happening. If you're in the archive, you know, looking, just, you know, go by the date and flip that other page over for upcoming shows. If you're looking for one that's coming, we're definitely here. We're just not as visible the way Blog Talk Radio has their board set up these days. So we want to welcome those new hosts that are coming on the earlier platform. And Les Paul, I'm glad that you're going to be doing the Independent Living Show, because there's just so much information there to be had. And heck, I didn't even know what that was when I first started here, and I've learned so much. I find myself quoting you now out and about. And so I encourage you guys all to tune in to Les's new show tomorrow, and then catch Fantastic Frank after. And with that, it is about 11:52, and if you don't mind, Les Paul, I'd like to go lay in a tub of ice. And it's time to let those dogs out, man. They were tortured in the heat today too. So we're at the 3-hour mark, and I want to thank everybody who stayed here to listen tonight and participate, whether it was being here listening, which is huge, or whether you were one of the callers. I want to thank my guest tonight, Robin Bloom. Again, I really want to thank my sponsor, Lash Publishing. Do check them out at lapublishing.com, and make sure to sign up for the free online e-version of Brain Injury Journey magazine, where you'll get to see my debut article there too for August. That was a pretty cool thing to wake up to when I got the email. And thank Gordon Johnson. I'm not getting tired. Gordon Johnson of TBI Law, who sponsors Brain Injury Radio. So I think that's my thanks to everybody. And invariably, in every single show that we have, let's see, let me find him. I'm out of place here. Invariably, in every show that we have, I hear somebody say this in one fashion or another, if not directly. And that's one of the reasons that I love this guy and I love this song, because I think it really, no pun intended, when you hear what I'm going to say, speaks to something that we all go through probably multiple periods of during our recovery. And I'm just going to let this song play out and tell you all goodnight. Thank you very much. And do stay and listen to the song. It's really awesome. Daniel Christian, Find My Voice. And you can check him out at danielchristianmusic.com. And I'll put that in the chat. danielchristianmusic.com. Thanks so much, everybody. Good night. Good night, Les Paul.
Good night. You have a great one. Great show.
You too. Thanks.
The question never seems to change. Are you with them or are you with us? And if it's true, I am not ashamed. There shouldn't be much to discuss. But for every answer that draws you near, there is an answer that will make you run. And as long as identity remains unclear, The coward will give the easy one. We can be automatic, carefully diplomatic. I need courage to speak my choice. Now that it's been a while since my courtyard denial, I am still trying to find my voice. I am still trying to find my voice. My brother is waiting to believe. We all love him just the same. There are gifts we both receive under the same sun and rain. I can't speak out of stillness, but I'm waiting to fill this space with courage to make my choice. How can we preach salvation from our own isolation? I am trying to find my voice. I am just trying to find my voice.
Now it's time to make my